Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In today's economic climate, we hear a lot about the challenges faced by job seekers. But employers have challenges as well. There's a growing gap between job skills required and the training students can get in high school, community colleges, and even four-year institutions. Joining me to talk about what employers are looking for and how students can better prepare, Emily DiRocco of the Manufacturing Institute, Byron Ogiest of McKinsey & Company, that's a global consulting firm, joining us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Gary Green. He's president of Forsyth Technical Community College. I do look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Byron, if I could start with you, how many jobs would you estimate are going unfilled because there are not sufficient numbers of people with the skills to fill them?
Well, Diane, it's a significant number. Even in this very difficult recession with a lot more people looking for work than there are jobs out there, in the healthcare professions and in the engineering professions, there are at least 800,000 jobs that are unfilled, which is to say there are at least 800,000 more positions that employers are searching for than there are workers with those skills looking for those positions.
And what about in the manufacturing sector?
True, in the manufacturing sector as well. The Department of Labor March reported about 228,000 manufacturing jobs going unfilled. This at a time that we clearly had unemployed workers and underemployed workers, but the mismatch in their education and skills with the high-tech skill requirements in today's advanced manufacturing sector are simply something we have to address.
Gary Green, how would you address the problem? What is the Forsyth Technical Community College doing to address that?
Well, I think this skills gaps is certainly sort of the main issue that we're facing as we make a transition in our community, in our region, from legacy industries and legacy jobs that are oftentimes low skills to the higher level skills, such as Brian just mentioned in health and engineering. The challenge is oftentimes workers coming out of those legacy industries have basic skill deficiencies. They may not have graduated from high school. They may need support to get into programs to prepare them for health technologies, advanced manufacturing, and other jobs that are being created in our economy today, such as green jobs. So it is that gap, and oftentimes it is the community college that's stepping in and filling that gap, not only here in North Carolina and Winston-Salem, but across the country. And we're doing that by more focus on bringing together adult basic education skills, working very hard to bring up developmental skills to prepare people for college-level work who may not be prepared.
Now, I gather there's another situation, which is you've got a whole bunch of 55 and older people ready to retire from many of those manufacturing jobs, many of the other jobs as well, Byron.
Yes, that's right. If you look across many of the engineering-intensive professions, it's certainly true in manufacturing. Some of the highest caliber workforce are in their 50s or even early 60s and on the verge of retirement, and there is going to be a need to refill those jobs and indeed upgrade the skills.
Emily.
Actually, in manufacturing today, we're looking at 2.7 million workers who are in that baby boomer retirement eligible age group. And that is a big gap to fill in manufacturing across everything from skilled production to our engineers responsible for innovation.
Now, isn't there an effort on the part of some corporations, some manufacturing groups, to partner with institutions to try to educate for the jobs that they need?
Actually, that is a very important initiative that's underway nationwide. The Manufacturing Institute, which is an affiliate of the National Association of Manufacturers that hosts 12,000 manufacturing members, in fact, is partnering with community colleges all across the country to take industry-recognized, nationally portable manufacturing skills credentials right into the degree programs in community colleges, so workers can quickly get a college credential that is directly aligned to the skills that manufacturers in their community need.
Give me some examples, Byron.
Well, Emily's just given a great example, and I just want to underscore the importance of what she said, which is that these are industry recognized skills. So skills and certifications that are recognized throughout the industry. Which means that they are portable. So Emily, do you want to give some examples?
Absolutely. For example, in the technical skills area, our manufacturers, regardless of whether they're in aerospace or biopharma, automotive or machining, they need some core production skills like health and safety, technology systems, supply chain management. They need machining and metal forming skills and the ever popular welding skills, which in some states now bring $70,000 a year as a starting salary. So these are very high tech technical skills that are, as we call them, they're applied STEM skills. They are the science, technology, engineering, and math skills that individuals actually learn in a project-based or performance-based environment.
Gary Green, what about the Forsyth Technical Community College? Are you partnering with any specific manufacturing firms? Oh, dear. Have we lost him? I'm afraid so.
I might be able to help there. Gary's college, actually, is one of four lead colleges across America in North Carolina, Ohio, Texas, and Washington State that have been the first to deploy the NAM-endorsed Manufacturing Skills Certification System with support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in their education reform efforts. And so Gary's college really is totally integrated the Manufacturing Skills Certification System into four of his associate degree programs of study.
So are there other learning institutions around the country, Byron, doing the same kind of thing?
Absolutely, there are. I mean, there are partnerships in many industries. So, for example, you might call out the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership in the state of Minnesota that is also working with community colleges and businesses to retrain workers. It's got a big manufacturing component. But what I'd really like to underscore is two features of these programs that are so important. First of all, in community colleges, many students, as Gary had mentioned before, arrive in community colleges with the need of some remediation because their high school education wasn't really up to snuff, not to what employers need. But we know that if you just put people in remedial education and give them remedial classes before you allow them to go on to their program of study, 5 out of 6 never go on to their program of study. It's a very depressing statistic. But if you integrate remediation into real job skills so that those students can see that they're making some progress and they're getting real skills that will allow them to be employed, as their basic skills are remediated, those programs are much more successful.
Gary Green, how much time do you have to spend on remediation? I'm afraid we have lost him again.
Let me emphasize on Gary's behalf and for all the community colleges that are working with us on the manufacturing skills credentialing system. Our foundational credential, Diane, is something called the National Career Readiness Certificate that ACT actually manages. And that National Career Readiness Certificate is in support of those remediation efforts. It's focused on the reading, applied math, and locating and using information that so many students today are not getting in their high school experience, that's critical certainly for any student who's dropped out.
It would seem as though, rather than focusing on the community colleges, you've got to go back to the high school level.
It is absolutely critical that this nation deal with the failures of K-12. 30% of our young people in the K-12 public school system are not graduating from high school on time. In large measure, we believe these students don't find their studies relevant to real life and the careers they're seeking. And we have such a huge deficit, particularly in math and science, which is so critical to manufacturers in every sector of our economy, that we must actually declare war on math remediation in this country, because otherwise it becomes an under-preparation tax for all of our colleges.
All right. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about the jobs that are out there just waiting for you. Short break, right back. Welcome back. We're talking about jobs that are waiting for the taking out there, but unfortunately, the educational skills to move into those jobs are not there, creating a huge gap in what is needed for manufacturing, what is needed for employment. Why this has happened in this last decade is really a mystery to me. Emily, how do you see it?
Well, I think it's a mystery to all of us, whether it's professionally or as parents. Somehow we've gotten to the point where young people are not required to take 4 years of math and science and English in their secondary school experience. Perhaps there are too many electives. Perhaps we have not associated the requirements in jobs and careers to the pathways that students take in education. It is critically important, and it's why manufacturers have stepped up to the plate in a major student outreach campaign to high schools and even middle schools to advise young people, stay in math, stay in science, because if you want to be in advanced manufacturing, turning your ideas into the next great products and we must remain a country that makes things, then you don't want to close those doors to that kind of career.
Byron, is there some feeling on the part of young students that these manufacturing jobs are somehow beneath them, and that what they're aiming for are four-year degrees and then perhaps law school or medicine rather than going into the manufacturing sector?
I do think that our education system and our society and our culture undervalues vocational work. And I think that our education system, if you look at our higher education system, if you're planning to go in a four-year degree, the path is sort of clear. But if you want to take another course and get into the vocations, it's not as clear what you do. Unlike some other countries like Germany, for example, where there are very clear pathways into manufacturing professions, into vocations of all sorts, apprenticeships and the like, I think our system is very uneven in that respect. It's quite difficult for a student to navigate. And I do believe there's a perception that that there aren't good jobs coming from vocational degrees. But as we've heard, there absolutely are. And that's true not only in manufacturing. I would say that's also true, for example, in healthcare. That's another field growing very rapidly where there are hundreds of thousands of open jobs today that can't be filled. Some of them, of course, demand lots of education, like physicians. Others are more medical technicians, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, a variety of jobs that actually present also a career path through the field.
All right. Here's a posting on Facebook which says, we sing a mixed tune about engineering education. To hear the media tell it, engineers write their own tickets. Yet I am an unemployed engineer in a great company of unemployed engineers, a rare commodity, able to get middle-class employment because of my education? Nope. That exists in the medical field. As for bankers and stockbrokers, a couple of good years and they can retire. You never hear about engineers' bonuses. If you're an engineer, chances are you know quite a few out-of-work engineers. Emily.
Interestingly, our engineers have tended to, in recent years, specialize, not unlike other professions. And we did see, for example, with the dot-com bust, a lot of software engineers that found themselves unemployed or underemployed. We are working very closely with the key engineering schools and universities all across this country and with their professional societies, like the Society of Manufacturing Engineers, to get to the core and foundational skill sets that will also allow our professional engineers to cut across sectors and have opportunities for a career lifetime, whether it be in aerospace or biopharma or alternative energy, in the growth sectors of manufacturing.
Here's an email from Joe in Silver Spring, Maryland. The solution is both trivial and profound. The problem will be solved when the high school math team has the same prestige as the high school football team. Byron.
Well, I certainly think those cultural factors do matter and that we absolutely should be celebrating academic
but
achievement more than we are. And I think that's a very important
thing.
And
at the same time, the federal government is cutting funds. We are having more and more trouble funding public education, Emily.
I do want to remind us, however, that we spend over $600 billion a year on public education and another $15 billion or more on what we call workforce development in this country. So I really question whether there isn't enough money out there. We're just not spending it correctly.
All right. I'm going to try to open the phones here and see what happens. Let's go first to Michael in San Antonio. Good morning. Are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go right ahead.
Okay. When I was in high school, we had what they call vocational and technical classes. And then when my son was in high school, they didn't teach him anything but the test to get ahead. There's no child left behind. The kids are not getting reading, writing, and arithmetic because teachers are only teaching them this new test. And that's all I wanted to say, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling. Emily.
Since you're from San Antonio, I do want to mention that the Alamo Colleges in San Antonio are one of our lead colleges in integrating the manufacturing skills certification system, but they have chosen to do it in two high school academies, one on advanced manufacturing and one in aerospace, where in 11th and 12th grade, the integrated curriculum will result in their students graduating from what you and I know as high school with their high school diploma, their National Career Readiness Certificate, and a direct tie to an employer, and up to 30 credits toward their associate degree that they have earned via their technical skills development with the manufacturing credentials.
You know, when I was in high school, they had mechanical drawing, they had apprentice workshops, they had all kinds of vocational opportunities for boys and girls. That seems to have been lost by the boards, Byron.
Yes, I think we're starting to realize that as a country we have perhaps over-tilted towards this four-year education as the singular model, and that we've given short shrift to vocational and technical education. And we need to rebuild those pathways for career success for our young people. And I think there's also a bit of a mythology that vocational and technical education is in some way second tier in terms of its rigor. And that's entirely untrue. If you look at the complexity both from a reading and communications as well as a mathematics standpoint for what's actually required in the modern workplace and advanced manufacturing and so forth, it's every bit as rigorous as what's required to succeed in a four-year college. It's just delivered in a different way that connects to some young people in a different way and also moves them forward towards career opportunities that some of them are quite excited and passionate about.
And let's see if we now have Gary Green back with us.
Yes.
I'm glad.
One of the things I think that we are seeing, we are seeing a resurgence and an increasing interest in bringing those technical skills and manufacturing skills and the kinds of thinking that's needed for those back into the high schools. And we're seeing it in specialized programs like at Alamo that Emily mentioned. I know in our community we're seeing that with a special academy in biotechnology and IT and visualization in one of our high schools here. I think secondary vocational school will look different going forward because it will be around these academies and also contextualizing the work that happens in mathematics and sciences, especially in secondary education, to make sure as we're teaching math that what we're teaching is grounded in the real world with examples and problems that come directly out of the workplace and that prepare students better for understanding the kind of careers that are available to them in these areas.
Byron.
Well, I just want to underscore the importance of contextualizing math and science, as Gary was talking about, and to say that this is going to apply not just to the professions that we think about as being technical professions. In the future, the use of mathematics and statistics is going to suffuse many different industries that we don't think about today. McKinsey Global Institute just put out a report called Big Data, which is looking at the way that massive databases of customer information, supply chain information are changing business. And one of the conclusions is that we're going to need a couple million managers that have the facility to use data to make business decisions. And this is across all industries, retail, everything else. So upward mobility in those industries is going to require facility with mathematics.
And joining us now is Michael Davidson. He's senior analyst at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning. Good morning.
I know that the OECD's recent analysis that compared the achievement of students from different countries surely does not paint a particularly positive picture for the U.S. Give us a sense of the numbers.
Well, what you say is true. This study that we conduct every 3 years assesses reading, math, and science literacy. So this is about not just what students have learned, but what they're able to apply, how they're able to apply that knowledge in real-life situations. So just to give you some numbers on the reading assessment, the U.S. students at age 15 come out around the OECD average compared to other countries. Science literacy, again, around the OECD average. And in fact, for mathematics, the performance of 15-year-olds in the U.S. is significantly below the OECD average. Now, we're able to compare trends over time because we've done this four occasions now, these tests. On reading, we see virtually no change over a 10-year period. Mathematics, a slight increase between the latest two assessments, but still mathematics is relatively weak compared to other countries, and some improvement on science over the last 3 years also. So a mixed picture, but not a particularly rosy one.
Yeah. And to what extent does this test that you've been giving take into consideration that some countries, for example, like the U.S., emphasize test-taking as opposed to problem-solving?
Well, the test actually is more geared to a test or an assessment of what students can do with the knowledge they've learned. So it's not simply a curriculum test. It is about applying that knowledge in real-life situations. There are some multiple-choice questions, but there are also some open-ended questions where we really try to get at the deep knowledge that students have got and how they can apply that in real-life situations. And there are countries who do very well in our tests who do not have a testing culture. Hmm. Finland, for example, is one of the countries that tends to top this league table. They simply don't have a testing culture in their system. So we are, if anything, more gearing towards testing problem-solving skills, real-world application of knowledge.
And what about the socioeconomic status of those young people taking the tests?
Well, we it's a random sample of 15-year-olds, so we get students from all corners of society. What we find, actually, for the United States is that the social background of the student has a stronger predictable quality in terms of the performance of the student. So, in other words, your social background is more likely to be a predeterminant of your success compared to other countries on average. And where we find countries that make progress in these tests over time, it's often by mitigating against those social disadvantages that has been the secret of their success for improving their scores over time.
Now, you talked earlier about where the U.S. stands in math and sciences and the other subjects. Who's at the top?
Well, among OECD countries, Korea is the top country in terms of reading and mathematics.
Korea.
Now, just to put this a little bit in perspective, the difference in the score that 15-year-olds have achieved in Korea compared to the U.S. is 39 score points on our test. Now, what does that mean? That represents about 1 year's worth of education. So you can put simply the fact that Korean students at age 15 on average are 1 year ahead of U.S. students on reading. The position, actually, the gap between the best performing countries and the U.S. is even larger when we look at mathematics and science, where that gap is actually more like 1.5 school years worth of education.
Where does Finland come out in this?
Well, Finland is the strongest country, the OECD country, on the science literacy assessment. So, again, they're scoring 50 points ahead of U.S. students on average, 1.5 years worth of education or equivalent. If we look outside of the OECD group of countries, Shanghai, China has participated for the first time in these studies. They scored an incredibly high score across the board on reading, maths, and science, so that the gaps between Shanghai, for example, and the U.S. is something of the order of over 100 points when it comes to mathematics. So, you know, it's almost 3 years' worth of education.
So what you're saying is that U.S. students would have to go to school 3 years longer to catch up with those in China.
In a simplistic assessment of the numbers, that's equivalent statement to make. That's right. And one of the, I mean, we look at mathematics, we break down the performance. One of the striking things in the U.S., and as is the case in many of the countries not performing particularly well in mathematics, is that a quarter of the students are performing at a level that we regard in our assessments as below the level required to make a successful transition from high school into the labor market or into further study. So that's a large proportion, 23%, in fact, are performing at that level where they're going to be challenged in whatever route they take beyond school.
Michael Davidson, he's senior analyst at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
The Obama administration backed off a plan aimed at protecting additional federal land as wilderness. As part of our ongoing Environmental Outlook series, The Battle Over Use of America's Wild Lands, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And before we go back to the phones, we've just heard from Michael Davidson of the OECD about the gap which exists between U.S. students in math and science skills and those in other, not only OECD countries, but China as well. Byron, you were talking during the break about what that means economically to this country.
Yes, McKinsey did a study a couple of years ago on the economic cost of the achievement gap in America's schools. And I want to highlight the cost of two of the gaps that Michael mentioned. The first, he mentioned that in the U.S., our socioeconomic status differences matter more to educational outcomes than they do in other countries. And that's, I mean, that's really a moral outrage. We've got 17 or 18 countries in the OECD where the family you were born into matters less for your success than it does in the United States, which is meant to be the land of opportunity. But that costs all of us. We estimated that the achievement gaps by income in this country cost the country somewhere around $600 billion in economic output. That would be the equivalent of what used to be thought of as a big recession, the sort of the early 90s or the 1980s recession. But then this gap that Michael talks about between the U.S. and the best performing countries in the world, that gap in achievement, we estimate that that accounts for somewhere between 9 and 16% of U.S. GNP. That's about $2 trillion. So in other words, that is as big a problem as the whole financial meltdown and Great Recession that we just experienced. It's just that it's an invisible problem. It's one that eats away at the fabric of our economy, and it's one that we really have to get serious about tackling.
Okay, let's go Go ahead.
One thing that Michael said certainly I think connects with what we've been talking about, and that is that the assessments that OECD used determine what students could actually do. So as we talked earlier about contextualizing mathematics, of making sure that we have applied principles in science and an understanding of hands-on work and manufacturing in these kinds of courses, that gets to what students can do. Also, the skill certifications, such as the Manufacturing Institute is working with community colleges and with trade associations like the American Welding Society and others. Those are very much attuned to making sure that students can actually apply technical, scientific, and mathematical learning, and is really getting at the issue of what students can do, which is where we're seeing this gap in the OECD data.
All right, let's take a call from Carrboro, North Carolina. Kira, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, my name is Kira Freskin. I'm 17, I'm a 17-year-old senior, and I go to Carrboro High School. And I've noticed that in my district, the classes that are really emphasized and are the AP and sort of college university prep classes. And there's already a pretty big socioeconomic as well as a racial divide. And so students, the higher income students are sort of pushed into the AP classes. And a lot of the lower income students end up, not doing very well in those classes. And because technical and career classes are given pretty low merit, there's not really another sort of opportunity for them or for the other students. I'm headed off to university next year, and just this year I've been taking Auto Tech, which is by far my favorite class, and it's also the only sort of, technical class that I've taken, practical class that I've taken my entire schooling career.
Good for you, Kira. It does seem to me that every person, not just every woman, but every person needs to understand how a car works, and you're certainly on the way, Emily.
Kara, there also will be jobs in the auto manufacturing and auto service areas that would love to reach out to you as even a university student. Let me emphasize that it is very clear that across all business sectors, certainly in manufacturing as well, the vast majority of jobs do require some post-secondary education, so some education and training beyond high school today, about two-thirds of our jobs, but not necessarily a four-year degree. Therefore, we have to really give students and parents and career counselors in the high school system much more information about career navigation and educational pathways.
Sure.
With the cost of college today,
exactly.
If they can get the degree they need in 2 years as opposed to 4 or 6.
Kira, what do you plan to study in college?
I'm actually planning to go in education and try to maybe change some of the perceptions about these classes. So.
Good for you.
Hoping to be a high school teacher.
Good for you. Thanks for calling and sharing with us. Now to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. I'm afraid I'm mirroring a bit of what the young lady you just had on was talking about. We mentioned earlier on this program that this stigma has been existing for the past 10 years. I think it's been around a lot longer. I grew up in an agricultural area of Western New York, and we were all the vocational classes were taught off-site at a different building, and as such, at one point in your sophomore year, I believe, you were given the choice. You could either do the vocational or you could do, you know, the basic college prep stuff, and you had there was no option of doing both. And if you even inquired about it, you were told point blank that those classes were pretty much for those kids. And it makes no sense to me that that stigma continues, and especially what the gentleman just said, with the cost of education being so high, why are we sending these kids out to four-year degrees that accumulate a massive amount of debt, and then where they could have learned the skills in high school to become, you know, construction workers or even work in an automotive line during the summer and make a substantially greater wage? Instead, we're perfectly okay as a country watching our young people wallow in debt, trying to repay a college debt by working at Target.
Emily.
Oh, it's so right. We're all shaking our heads with you here in the studio. It is absolutely important for this nation to reestablish educational pathways that recognize competency-based education, not seat time, but mastery or proficiency of
skills. What do you mean
skills.
By seat time, Emily?
Well, if you stop and think about it, Diane, we run our entire public education system and even talk about it in terms of specific seat time, the proverbial sitting in a classroom, and our schedule for K-12, for example, there you go, I just did it. It is built on the agricultural calendar so that we don't go to school in the summer when crops are being harvested, kind of that 19th century mentality. Our classroom style is a 20th century industrial model of teacher with people in seats for exactly the same amount of time every year, and they must move through their standardized tests in order to complete a certain amount of time, whether it's K-12 or then 2 years in community colleges or 4 years in our colleges and universities. If we move to competency-based proficiency or mastery, this is what career and technical education is about and why other countries and our competitors are, in fact, changing the way they're educating their students.
All right. To Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, good morning, Diane. I just had a brief comment. I'm a former physicist, NASA employee with a strong background in computer science. There's nothing I enjoy more than working on science, and I love the industry. However, due to the lowering of engineering salaries, the lack of R&D funding, and H-1B visas that are down, out depressing the wages for us, I found it more profitable and that I had more job security by opening a blue-collar company. And I think just this is a systemic problem.
What kind of a blue-collar company did you open, Sean?
Well, it's not quite your standard trade. It's more of a tourism company. It's a very small, couple-employee, tourism-based company.
Interesting.
It can't be outsourced or taken away.
Yeah. Carrie Green, do you want to comment?
Well, I think that's not unusual today. One of the things that you're finding at community colleges is that we're increasingly becoming, in a way, the new graduate school, in that individuals who sometimes have baccalaureate degrees who are finding the economy, the jobs are not growing in that area, are finding some of these technical applied skills, and as the caller described, is even blue-collar, though they're not all blue-collar jobs, those hands-on blue-collar jobs are now not only available, but are really skills that people can build good careers, good incomes, and support themselves and their family in some ways better than some of the traditional jobs that we've thought of as requiring a college education. Goes back to that point of the new jobs in the economy, as I think Emily or someone was saying earlier, the new jobs in the economy are not also always at that baccalaureate or post-baccalaureate level, but they're at the technical level.
Here's another perspective. James has said, if industry wants a better prepared workforce, then industry should pay for the education. Here in Washington State, says James, many of the very corporations who want properly prepared employees pay little or no taxes. As is always the case, they love to shift the cost of educating their workforces to the public sector. Byron, do you want to comment?
Well, I think there are a number of ways that industry can make a difference here. First of all, I do think it's incredibly important that industry work very closely with the public university system and the public community college systems to make clear which skills are required and to work to establish these common standards so that the money that is spent on education can be spent most cost effectively. I think another thing that industry can do, and maybe it doesn't do enough, is to make clear businesses are actually making their investment decisions based on the quality of the workforce in a given area. I think many people assume in the general public that all the business cares about is having low wages or low taxes. But in fact, it's incredibly important to have a high quality workforce for many different industries. And those are, we know from our work with human resources professionals and companies in making investment decisions, that those are critical factors. I do think business could elevate that and make it more visible so that the public could see the importance of this.
But why is it that the, you know, foundations like Bill and Melinda Gates have to go in and provide that funding for special education to ensure that those high school students, for example, or even community college students will come out with the education they need?
Well, when a foundation like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation goes in and does this sort of creative collaboration between business and the public sector, they're serving as a catalyst to show how we can create new models. You can never expect private philanthropy to actually fund those models at scale. Ultimately, that funding will have to come from some mix of public sector and private sector, but they play a very important role in catalyzing innovation and helping to show what can work.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a caller in Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi. Good morning, Dan. I was calling because I'm a science teacher, ex-science teacher, and earlier some of your commenters spoke about our math and science preparedness of our students and said that we didn't need 4 years, but in Texas, actually, we do require them to take 4 years of math and science in high school. Well, my point is that this doesn't help because we just relax the standards so that everyone passes. There's a lot of institutional pressure to pass the students, especially if they passed on our the tax test down here. That's our standardized test. So especially if they pass the standardized test, we get a lot of pressure to pass them. And passing on that test is only a 55.
Wow.
So it's kind of a political. It's really, really bad. And so there's just a lot of political pressure and institutional pressure. And, you know, counselors will sidle up to you and say, hey, you know, he passed the tax test. Is there anything? Can we give him some extra credit? And, you know, he has like a 60 or a 40. It's really, really bad. But that's just kind of an institutional problem that we have all through the K through 12.
Emily.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's one of the reasons that the National Governors Association, the chief state school officers, and business organizations like the NAM and Manufacturing Institute are supporting the National Common Core Standards Initiative around math and science. We can't afford to not have high standards in every state in this country.
Now, this is interesting. An email from Richard, who says our high schools are failing to adequately train a manufacturing workforce. Number one, a local HR manager gives applicants a ruler and an object to measure. As many as 40% cannot accomplish the task. Number two, while teaching blueprint reading to supposedly skilled workers in a manufacturing facility, I found only one of six could convert fractional dimensions to decimal equivalents. And three, too many guidance counselors have no idea what skills are required. He's not good in school, but he's good with his hands. Something's got to be done. And it seems to me it really is going to take a partnership with manufacturing, with the schools, with the foundations to come up with a way to improve this system.
Absolutely. Although we were one of those jump-started by the major education philanthropies to move our business partnership forward, I will say that the president has put a huge emphasis on building more business education partnerships, making sure that the voice of the job creators is helping to change an educational system that has failed too many students.
Emily DiRocco of the Manufacturing Institute, Byron O'Geest of McKinsey & Company, Gary Green, president of the Forsyth Technical Community College. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.